Today on Against the Grain, there's so much activism, there's activism of all kinds, but who's heard of grief activism? According to Maurice Stierl, collective acts of grief and commemoration can constitute a transformative political practice. I'm CS, the Comparative Border Studies scholar, joins me to discuss the politics of grief in, specifically, migration struggles in and around the Mediterranean, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Grieving is considered a personal matter, something done in private. But what if what is being grieved are deaths and disappearances of an intensely political nature? And what if the grieving is done collectively? Now, when I say the militarization of the border, you might think of the U.S.-Mexico border, but another migration crisis of monumental proportions has been playing out, is still playing out, in the maritime border zone of Europe, that is, the Mediterranean Sea, which well over a million people tried to cross just last year. Fact is, thousands of people who have left places like Turkey and Libya for places like Greece and Italy have drowned in the Mediterranean. By one count, 258 people have already died at sea in the first 6 weeks of 2017. Well, what if the Mediterranean became a place of solidarity instead of a mass grave for migrants? What if a community, a political community, could emerge from scenes of collective grief? And what if what Maurice Stierl calls grief activism can both commemorate the lives that have been lost and assert a radical critique of the European border regime? Maurice Stierl is a visiting assistant professor in comparative border studies at the University of California, Davis. His research focuses on migration struggles in contemporary Europe and on activist interventions in the Mediterranean Sea. When Maurice Stierl joined me in studio, he had this to say about an article he wrote about grief activism for the journal Citizenship Studies.
So when I wrote this piece, I was thinking about what it actually means to be involved in activist practices that protest border deaths around the world. And my emphasis was on situations of grief activism around the Mediterranean Sea, where, as we know, it is the deadliest border zone in the world. And I was very fortunate to take part in these forms of what I refer to as grief activism to protest mass suffering and death at sea. So I wanted to explore what actually happens when people come together collectively to grieve a life that has been lost. And especially when thinking through forms of solidarity that are not based within, say, the civil society of a state or something, but that is transgressive, that is transboundary. So I was inspired by the work of Judith Butler in particular, who thought about the potentiality of grief. So something that is not only, say, private, that, happens behind closed doors, but that is also something that brings people together, that can potentially bring a community into being. And so I was really interested in thinking about what it might mean to come together collectively in protest, but also in grief over border deaths in the world.
Judith Butler is a theorist based at UC Berkeley. Tell us more about what she says about grief activism and what she says about lives that are grieved and perhaps lives that are not.
So I was particularly inspired by her work and her writings on what she calls precarious lives and grievability. So she basically asks, what is life that is grievable and what is life that is ungrievable and why? So whose lives are recognized as, deserving to be mourned and whose lives are seen as not deserving to be mourned? And, it is clear, I think, that if we look around in the world, that there are a lot of lives that seem to be ungrieved, right? That are being lost and, lives and bodies that disappear and that, are not mourned collectively. So I think Butler's work really allows us to think about the sort of radical inequality that exists between lives that are recognized as worth living and those that remain unrecognized and absent. So what she also argues then is to think about these precarious lives as lives that need to prompt us to reflect on the very condition of life and what makes life worth living and who recognizes whom as a life that has been fully lived.
So when you were saying earlier about how grieving can bring people together and create community and events or maybe even establish a kind of solidarity, what I'm hearing from you is that you see grieving as not just an individual or a collective practice, but as a political practice. Is that true? And if so, can you elaborate on what the political meaning or potential of mourning is?
Yes, definitely. I think that these grief activist practices are deeply political, especially when we have to think about these deaths were consequences of asymmetrical exposures to harm, right? So to the kind of radical inequalities that exist in the world and that some people have to, you know, that when they travel, they cannot get on a plane, they cannot get on a ferry, that they have to get into the hands, for example, of smugglers, onto precarious boats, and the exposure to, you know, life-threatening circumstances is, of course, very real for them. So I think that when we think about why all of these people, more than 5,000 people in the Mediterranean last year, lost their lives, you know, we have to think about the political dimensions of their death. So mourning these absences is a political act in itself. And again, to resort to Judith Butler's words, she says that, you know, many people think that grief is privatizing, that it returns us to a solitary situation and is in that sense depoliticizing. But I think it furnishes a sense of political community of a complex order. And I, in my article, I really wanted to emphasize this, you know, coming together of various different subjects who inhabit different positionalities and that come together collectively to mourn death at borders.
Well, let's get into some specifics. And let's start with the Boats for People campaign, which was launched in 2012 in the Central Mediterranean Sea. This was an international coalition, right?
Yes, Boats for People was a international solidarity campaign that took place in Italy and in Tunisia in the summer of 2012 to protest the mass dying, which had followed the Arab uprisings of 2011. So especially young Tunisians had taken to the sea in that year in 2011, and many had disappeared. More than 1,500 deaths are known and are recorded, but of course, it is very likely that many more have passed away. So we got together in Italy, and it was a very diverse coalition of activists, of migrant communities, of researchers, and so forth, who tried to protest what was going on at sea.
And what did this campaign, what did these folks accuse European Union border authorities of doing or of neglecting to do?
So this solidarity campaign was making the case that it is, of course, due to the European border regime that the Mediterranean is so deadly. So the Mediterranean is not just simply a space, say, of nature, right, that is unpolitical, but the space of the sea and the forces of the sea are being used as deterrents as part of the European border regime. So the sea is used to kill in many ways, right? And so we, when we traveled to Italy and Tunisia, we wanted to make the case that these deaths are not some natural deaths that just happened to occur in the Mediterranean, but they were the result of migration policies and the border regime that only allows for certain migration routes.
And Boats for People suggest that they used boats, they used ships to do something, to make their point. I understand that they envisioned originally deploying a fleet of vessels in the Mediterranean. Did that come to fruition?
No, it did not. So the idea was really to, you know, have a presence at a sea. So to intervene not only symbolically, but, you know, with a variety of vessels that could potentially intervene, you know, support migrants at risk at sea, and also monitor European coast guards and for example, the European border agency Frontex. This did not work out in the end, mainly due to resources, but it really gave rise to what we can see now, which are humanitarian interventions at sea.
So what kinds of commemoration or mourning practices did Boats for People engage and participate in and organize?
So part of the Boats for People campaign was this one sailing boat that went from different places in Italy to Tunisia. And wherever it stopped, there were interventions at the places, you know, mainly at certain ports. So quite often at seafronts, activists and locals and the families of the disappeared gathered to have these public commemorations. And so parts of these commemorative practices were to, you know, allow people to speak, especially, of course, those who had been directly affected by border violence. We try to also get in touch with, you know, local activist groups, and we try to make the case that these deaths did not have to occur, that they are not a natural phenomenon, but, you know, they need to be protested and they need to be remembered.
So families of the disappeared. So this obviously took some coordination, right? Because the activists and organizers, they had to find people who had died at sea or disappeared in the Mediterranean. They had to collect people together for these practices, for these interventions at the seaports.
Yes. So this is also, I think, why I was so fascinated by these grief activist practices, because it required, you know, a sort of coalition, a coming together of various different people and groups that had been, you know, in different ways been affected by the European border regime and its violence. And of course, coordinating these encounters was very complex, and the encounters themselves were also very complex. And that's something that I describe in the piece, because of course a lot of the families of the disappeared were still hoping to find traces of their children, you know, even sometimes years after they had lost touch with their children. So it was a very difficult encounter, because, you know, quite often the assumption that they are still alive cannot be taken from them, because this is something they, you know, obviously hope for. At the same time, you know, the likelihood of the children still being alive, it's not that great. And so, you know, coming together over the disappearance of someone is a highly delicate and, you know, very challenging act.
Another issue that you write about has to do with cultural and linguistic differences, right? Because you have people coming together, hailing from different nations, and they're trying to communicate with each other and communicate something to observers.
So in this piece, I'm trying to emphasize the difficulty and in some ways the impossibility of grief activism, right? So this is why I find this notion that Judith Butler advances, a community of a complex order, really important, because it is not a simple act, right, to stand in solidarity with someone at the border who's lost a loved one. So when thinking about migrant solidarity, I want to emphasize that it is challenging, that it involves complex encounters and a lot of negotiation as well, right? So it requires us, I think, to move beyond the, you know, conception of just standing in solidarity with someone who is maybe legible to yourself, and has a certain, you know, kind of common interest or the same political values, the same political opinions and experiences. So what I kind of contend is, when conceiving of this sort of trans-border solidarity, that any engagement must necessarily involve, you know, encounters that are problematic and, if you will, riven from the very beginning, simply because togetherness at the margins and despite the margins is necessarily problematic from the very beginning. And as you said, you know, there are various factors that play a role here. There are cultural differences, linguistic differences, there are different historical backgrounds, economic differences, gender differences, and so on, that all impact and often underlie these solidarity attempts. So I think turning to the notion of a complex community is important, because I want to problematize the idea of easy solidarities.
Maurice Skirl joins us in studio. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. He is visiting assistant professor in comparative border studies at the University of California, Davis. And his research focuses on migration struggles in contemporary Europe and on activist interventions in and around the Mediterranean Sea. We're focusing on an article he wrote about the role of grief in migration struggles for the journal Citizenship Studies. Yeah, what about, you mentioned economic differences. What about just somebody who isn't economically vulnerable trying to identify with or empathize with somebody who is vulnerable, perhaps to the extreme, in terms of their economic and social situations?
Yes, definitely. You know, there are various different subjects and positionalities that encounter one another. And I think this is why I called it also a form of impossible solidarity, because you can never fully re-feel what this person must have felt, you know, when either losing someone or when losing their own lives. So I think it is to recognize this gap that remains, right? There is something that is impossible that we cannot just re-feel as European solidarity activists who have probably never ever been in a situation where they might have to experience this kind of murderous violence that borders often inhabit. And so a form of precariousness that only exists for certain parts of this of the world's population. But instead of seeing this impossibility as something negative, I see it as a struggle, right, that engenders maybe possibly a future of living together, which does not shy away from living with differences and living with complexities, but that embraces that.
What was involved in the Boats for People commemoration in Berlin in December 2012, and why was it held there?
So Germany is one of the main architects of the European border regime, and people seem to forget that, especially now that, you know, Angela Merkel is praised as being the refugee chancellor and so forth, when in fact the European border regime is also based upon models that were advanced in Berlin in Germany, right? So we wanted to make the case that death that seems so far away, you know, in the Mediterranean Sea, where bodies wash up in Tunisia, Libya, or if at all in Malta or Italy and so forth, that these border deaths, you know, also are tightly interrelated to the policy advances made in a very central European country, which is Germany. So we went to the train station, the main train station in Berlin during the Christmas period, and also wanted to use this, all these activities that happened around the train station, you know, these festive activities, to remember those who, of course, could not celebrate or, you know, were not even alive at that moment due to something that for which the German government has to bear responsibility.
And so what did you folks do at the train station?
So some of us gave speeches, and we also had this banner with names of thousands of border deaths, which had been collected by United, which is a NGO that collects border deaths and that compiles these long lists. And we had a banner that listed all of them, which we rolled out. And, you know, as you can imagine, there are thousands and thousands of names. So there's a very long list. And so people quite often had to deal with this list, you know, because they had to cross over. And so they, quite a lot of tourists stopped and took a look and engaged sometimes with some of us. So on this list, there are not only names, but if there are more information about the deceased people, it is also written on it. So names, where they were found, the causes of death, and so forth. And so I think it's quite a powerful tool to, you know, humanize those absences, who are of course not just numbers as they often appear, but they are individuals who, you know, died in often horrific circumstances.
Let's turn to another project. It's called Traces Back 2013. It took place on the Greek island of Lesvos in 2013, and that place is, for many, the first point of entry into European space. It's only about 6 miles away from mainland Turkey. So what did this project involve?
So TracesBack was organized by different activist collectives based in Europe. And the idea was to allow those who had first encountered Europe on Lesbos to allow them to return to the island. So this is why it was called TracesBack. And also to protest what was at the time going on the island. So there were a lot of young migrants who had come from various places, Afghanistan, and so forth, to allow them to return to Lesbos, where they had quite often arrived years earlier on boats, and to, you know, collectively think about strategies, how to, you know, counteract the ongoing violence of the border regime. And Lesbos, of course, in the last few years has become a notorious place for migrant arrivals. Hundreds of thousands arrived in 2015, and also in the early months of 2016, thousands arrived. But so this action took place a bit before the kind of mass migration movements to Europe.
And when you're saying that migrants are returning to this site, you're saying that these are people who actually successfully made it into Europe, right? So they're coming from other parts of Europe to back to their point of entry into Europe.
Yes, many of them had to struggle for many years, you know, lived without shelter in Greece, in Athens and Patras and elsewhere, and then finally managed to reach places they wanted to reach and where they found protection. So some arrived in Sweden and Germany and elsewhere. And this was their chance to, you know, kind of retrace their steps and come back to the place where they had first set their feet on European territory. And it was really important for them to kind of deal with what they had experienced. You know, a lot of them were really young when they arrived. You know, some were 14, 15, 16, sometimes coming alone on these boats. So these were deeply troubling and traumatizing experiences. And this was a way to work through these experiences.
So how important was the act of commemoration to the focus of TracesBack?
The commemorations as part of the TracesBack intervention, I think, were really crucial. So a lot of the activists who were part of that had already protested border deaths for many years. They had also discovered a mass grave in the Evros region a few years earlier.
Is this in Greece?
Yeah, that was along the Turkey-Greek border, the land border. And, you know, there were dozens, hundreds of bodies discarded into nameless graves. And they protested not only the deaths, but also the way in which the dead bodies had been treated, quite often buried not according to cultural customs and so on. So it was a central kind of part of this activist campaign. And it was also highly relevant because only months earlier, you know, a lot of people had actually died in this little stretch of water. And I think it is really important to visualize this space. So when you stand on Lesbos Island, you know, you can not only see Turkey, which is, as you said, 6 miles away, about 6 miles, but you can even see buildings. You know, you can see things move on the other side. So that in this little stretch of water, hundreds die is, of course, you know, deeply troubling. So it was an intervention that protested this ongoing dying. And, you know, we, of course, at the time did not know that only a few years later, hundreds of thousands would actually make this particular crossing and hundreds of lives would be lost.
And a lot of the dying and drowning, this was due to the, I mean, in the most immediate sense, it was due to the boats being too rickety and essentially disintegrating in the water before it could actually make a very short trip over to Greece, correct?
Yes. So a lot of people have, you know, different experiences when it comes to the Aegean Sea, because during a, say, warm summer day, it could be a very easy crossing, if you will. It can only take a few hours. But, you know, there are currents, there are, you know, high waves at times, and a lot of these boats are, as you said, rickety, and they're not capable of carrying the number of people they usually carry. So we have had a lot of capsized vessels, even in this small stretch of water. Yeah.
So at this event, at this intervention in Lesvos, where you have these activists, you have these migrants now in Europe, now based in Europe, returning to where they first arrived. What was that like? What was the emotional state of the crowd? Of you know, I'm just wondering what the psychological effect of these actions, at least as far as you could discern at the event, was.
So you have to imagine that there are different people coming together. There were Syrian relatives who had lost people at sea, and they were part in organizing this commemoration. Then we also had local fishermen who had not only sometimes gone out at sea to rescue, but they had also sometimes retrieved corpses from the sea. Then you had locals who joined in the protest, and you had these international activists, some of whom had, you know, for many years already protested death at sea. And then, of course, you had the quite often still young migrants, refugees, who had returned to their, you know, place of first encountering Europe. So you had all these different people who joined into a collective sort of commemoration. And as you can imagine, that, you know, so many were traumatized by what they had experienced, that it was a very emotional coming together. And for me, it was very powerful. And I think a quote in the article, one of these referred to as a border survivor, who says that, you know, at the harbor, we were, you know, encountering death. And then when leaving this place, we walked back into life.
And what did you see as the political dimensions of what took place among this diverse group of people?
So I think, again, to think about this complex order, community of a complex order, is that we cannot, of course, assume that all of the actors involved share the political claim toward a borderless world or the freedom of movement and so forth. But we were united in denouncing the deadly and violent dimension of the European border regime. And I think that is the political dimension, to think about how can we foster communities in opposition to a regime that continues to disappear and kill people, and how can we then, you know, remain connected in some ways so that kind of futures become possible that involve groups from a variety of places, so that allows for trans-border solidarities.
That's Maurice Stierl, visiting assistant professor in comparative border studies at the University of California, Davis. We'll take a short break and speak more with Maurice about a lot of things, including the current state of migration across the Mediterranean Sea. Please stay with us. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Maurice Stierl joins me. His last name is spelled S-T-I-E-R-L. He is a comparative border studies scholar based currently at the University of California, Davis, and he is a member of the activist project Watch the Med Alarm Phone, which I've interviewed him about before on this program, and he calls himself an activist researcher. We are talking about his writings about the role of grief and grief activism in migration struggles in Europe and around the Mediterranean. Let's talk now about the Center for Political Beauty. It's an interesting name. It's an artist collective based in Germany. What did they do in November 2014?
The Center for Political Beauty is an artist collective that's quite notorious now for their artistic interventions. In 2014, they organized an intervention on the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And in this intervention, they removed 14 white crosses which had been erected near the German parliament in Berlin. And these crosses were there to commemorate actually German border victims, so people who had died along the East and West German border between 1961 and 1989. So these activists and artists, they in some way stole these crosses and they brought them to the external European borders, including to the forests in Morocco, where a lot of sub-Saharan Africans are organizing to attack the fences toward the Spanish enclaves or to cross the Mediterranean Sea and reach Spain.
So they're literally moving these white crosses around from place to place. Why are they doing that?
So these activists and artists wanted to draw parallels, of course, between today's border deaths and historic border deaths. As I said, between 1961 and 1989, while the Berlin border was still in place, a few hundred people died there. But every year now, especially in the past few years, every year more than 10 times die in the Mediterranean Sea, right? So it's not only to make the parallels, but also to denounce that there is a war, that there is a war that seems to be quite often invisible because it is the sea that disappears people.
Some activists, I understand, went to Bulgaria. What happened there and how were they treated by authorities?
So the Center for Political Beauty is known for a very kind of confrontational stance when it comes to authorities. So even before leaving, a lot of these activists were closely monitored. They were checked for tools because they had said that they would take down certain borders. And so when they reached the external border zones of Europe, they were always escorted by police forces and they were not really allowed to get anywhere near the fences. And so they could not do what they wanted to do, is to, tear down these walls and fences. But, it was also a highly symbolic action that was discussed in the media. It was discussed in the German parliament. And it drew a lot of critique, especially from conservative politicians who said, the memories of the German border deaths were desecrated through these acts, which is, of course, quite stunning, this argument.
Well, what's the objection to that argument? What does that reaction of, say, conservative Germans to what the Center for Political Beauty was doing, what does that say that is so alarming to you and so many other people?
So the activists from the Center for Political Beauty responded to these allegations, but saying that, the memories were not desecrated. The memories were actually held high. By drawing the comparison to today's border fatalities, to make the parallels is really important. If you want to learn from historic forms of border atrocities and violence, then of course we have to relate it to the contemporary condition.
And also I understand there was some concern that this German reaction said something, implied something about the grievability of certain lives as opposed to other lives.
Yes, I think the racialization of border deaths is very important, right? Again, to return to Judith Butler and to think about whose lives are recognized as worth grieving over. And if we think about these thousands of people, quite often, black and brown, who disappear every year and there's hardly any mourning, then we, of course, have to think about why there was such an outrage around, the removal of some crosses. And why was there the claim that, the lives or the memories of those who had died that were desecrated?
So why, if the authorities were at various times accompanying or escorting these activists with the Center for Political Beauty as they went to, for example, external border regions of Europe and maybe an attempt to dismantle the fences they found there, but as you said, the authorities were there to prevent them from doing that, why didn't the authorities take back, reclaim the 14 white crosses that these activists had taken and were bringing around the region?
So these activists and artists are very clever, and they hijacked the situation, and they disappeared these crosses, I think, very quickly. And so at first, nobody really noticed. And then it was somehow too late, I think, for authorities to reclaim them. And so they also did these kind of photo ops, if you will, in the woods of Morocco, where they gave some of the sub-Saharan Africans who were there these white crosses. And so you have pictures of sub-Saharan migrants carrying crosses on which the names of German border deaths are written. And I think this is a really powerful symbol.
In June 2015, the activists, I think this is still the Center for Political Beauty, launched a campaign they called The Dead Are Coming. What did they do?
So that was probably the most controversial act. What they did was unearth border deaths or border fatalities that were stored somewhere in Italy, in a hospital container, for example. And they wanted to bring these deaths, as they said, to the center of the European border regime, which they made out to be Berlin. So they got the permission of the relatives of the deceased, some of whom actually lived in Berlin, and they wanted to allow for a proper burial. So they went to Italy, they got the bodies, and they brought them actually in a caravan to Germany.
And what happened?
So at the same time, they had not only organized these official burials, but they had also created a protest movement. So a lot of people, thousands of people gathered in Berlin that coincided sometimes with some of the burials that they announced very late so that they could not be kind of stopped by authorities.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Maurice Stierl joins us. He is visiting assistant professor in comparative border studies at UC Davis, where he is also a member of the Comparative Border Studies Initiative. So we used to hear a lot about deaths and drownings among people making dangerous trips from places like Turkey or Libya to Europe. And we haven't heard so much about that anymore because, in large part, I think, because of the deal that the EU struck with Turkey, and that seemed to have reduced the flow of migrants. What can you tell us about the current state of migrant flows from North Africa and the Middle East to Europe?
The situation in the Mediterranean is really grim and devastating, even if it's not discussed a lot in the media. Last year, we had yet another record number of deaths at sea. So more than 5,000 people died, and that's only those who were counted. And we know that, of course, at sea, a lot of people simply disappear and remain unaccounted for. And these 5,000 deaths occurred during a year when sea migration actually went down. So in 2015, we had more than 1 million people cross the sea. We had more than 3,007 fatalities. In 2016, we had 360,000 crossings, but 5,000 deaths. So the mortality rate has gone up significantly, which means that sea crossings become ever more dangerous. So in the last 3 years, more than 12,000 people are known to have died. Which is obviously a very shocking number. And we know that this year it will continue necessarily because the European border regime is determined to deter more than ever. In early January, or in mid-January actually, more than 250 people drowned. And actually, as the Watch the Met alarm phone, we were trying to reach out to this boat. We had a satellite phone number of one of the people on the boat, but we were never able to reach them. And then we had to find out later that the boat had actually capsized and about 200 people had died with only a handful of survivors. So the situation in the Mediterranean continues to be dramatic. And this year, about 10,000 people have crossed the Mediterranean Sea so far. And if we think about last year, it seems that it is a much smaller figure because last year in the first 4 or 5 weeks, about 80,000 people had done this crossing. This is, of course, due to the EU-Turkey deal that you mentioned. At the same time, last year, sea migration through Libya has gone up. So we can expect that sea migration will continue and maybe even grow for the central Mediterranean Sea. And we know that there are a lot of people in Libya waiting to cross.
So you recently returned from Europe, and on this visit, you managed to interview a number of people who had made the migration across the Mediterranean Sea. You spoke to, among other people, a man who went from Libya to Italy in October 2016. That's fairly recently. What did you learn about his experience?
So what we wanted to gather is a direct account of how they organized their migration from, say, Somalia or Ethiopia to Libya and then to Europe. So what we wanted to have is a very detailed and precise account of, you know, when they made what decision to take this route or to go with this smuggler. And what we learned, and which was verified also by, you know, various reports of human rights organizations and NGOs, is that the situation in Libya is simply devastating, right, in terms of human rights abuses, in terms of how especially sub-Saharan migrants have to suffer sometimes for years before they can even get to the sea, and how then quite often those who do want to cross the sea are still forced onto these boats, and so they cannot say in the last moment, for example, when the sea is rough and so on, that they do not want to go. So it's a highly terrifying situation. We learned that people are discarded in the desert. There are large camps in the desert where thousands are held by, you know, different smuggling networks. They are being extorted. They have to call family members so that they transfer money. The women are quite often raped. There's an incredibly high number of rape and, you know, sexual harassments that occur there. There are various forms of torture, incarceration, and so forth. So this all happens before people reach the sea. The cruelty was just simply devastating.
When we think of the suffering of these people, we think of the deaths and the disappearances and the drownings at sea. And what you're saying is the vulnerability, the extraordinary vulnerability of these people begins well before they even get on that rickety boat trying to make this journey, which may not get anywhere or may be intercepted by European security boats. You know, the vulnerability that precedes the voyage is just appalling.
Yes, so when we think about precarious forms of migration, we have to start much earlier. A lot of people only focus on the very last border obstacle, if you will. Also here in the U.S., you know, when people focus on the U.S.-Mexican border, the Sonoran Desert and so forth, in the European context, the Mediterranean Sea, which is really important, but I think it is important to connect these border sites to other border sites that preceded this large obstacle, right? So in the case of Europe, you know, people from sub-Saharan Africa, they had to cross various borders, and, you know, they had experienced various forms of violence much earlier. And quite often this is also a gendered form of violence. So you have very different experiences when you're, quite often different experiences when you interview men or women or children. And so we have to be careful about overthinking the European border as simply being at the edge of European territory, but actually the European border stretches much further down south, east, northwest. When we think about these processes of border externalization, we at least try to gain access to what it means for many people to experience the border, which is displaced, right? Which is not only in Europe, but which they feel already, say, in the Congo or elsewhere, before they even decide to leave.
I'm joined by Maurice Stierl, and he is a visiting assistant professor at UC Davis, and he is studying and he is a part of a number of activist interventions in and around the Mediterranean Sea. He's a member of the activist project Watch the Med Alarm Phone. Do we know, Maurice, currently where the bulk of people taking boats to Europe ultimately hail from?
So if you follow the UNHCR statistics, we know that the first three nationalities are Syrians, Afghans, and Nigerians who have done the crossing this year. And as we know, quite often Syrians cross from Turkey, while a lot of sub-Saharan Africans, but also others, you know, including Bangladeshi, Pakistani, and so forth, North Africans, cross from Libya.
There's been a lot of reported tension between Turkey and the EU, and I'm wondering to what extent we can say that Turkey is still adhering to the deal it made in terms of not allowing or discouraging migrants from leaving its shores on their way to places like Greece.
So Turkey has an incredible amount of leverage over the EU, and Erdogan in particular makes
the president.
Yeah, the president Erdogan makes use of this leverage whenever he can to threaten the EU with kind of opening the borders again, as they were fairly open in 2015. So to, you know, gain money, to have political impact on the agenda of the EU, and, you know, because the EU member states are so scared that there might be another episode of mass immigration, they basically do whatever Erdogan wants them to do, which is a scary situation when we think about, you know, the human rights situation in Turkey, the authoritarian tendencies of the Turkish regime and so forth.
It's been made very clear by actually you when you were last on this program how determined European authorities are to stop the flow of people into Europe. Is there anything we can say about current European authority strategies in terms of trying to deter people to make certain paths to Europe especially difficult or even impossible for migrants?
So ideally, European leaders want Mediterranean migration to stop, right? So this is, again, why they want to externalize the border so that people do not even reach the coastal states of Northern Africa, for example. And so they want to push them further down. So border externalization practices are, for example, connected to development policies and money that is given as part of development packages, which are in the end ultimately there to deter forms of migration to Europe. And the current situation is highly problematic. So the EU leaders met only a few days ago in Malta to really strategize about how to fight unauthorized sea migration. And what they drew up was a declaration which focuses on the role of Libya. And they've come up with a couple of points which are kind of the usual strategies that we've already seen in the past, which are exactly these externalization policies. So what we have now is that they are collaborating already with Libyan authorities, especially with the Libyan coast guards, and they even train the Libyan coast guards on European vessels so that Libyan coast guards can kind of collect people who are still within Libyan waters and return them to Libya. So Europe is basically paying others to do the dirty work. So, you know, they need the support of authoritarian and dictatorial regimes in the world to enact their migration policies. And unfortunately, a lot of these governments and regimes in Northern Africa are, you know, part of this. And so, for example, the UN-backed prime minister of Libya has already suggested that NATO and EU forces can also potentially even come into Libyan waters so that, you know, people can even more quickly be apprehended and returned to Libya, so in back into forms of detention where they experience torture and so forth. And even more than that, this Malta declaration envisions a support of Libyan border authorities to the south so that people are not even able to reach Libya in the first place. So it's this outsourcing, the externalization of borders, that people won't be able to get anywhere near the sea. And what I personally find so awful about it is this kind of perversity that a lot of these policies are framed in the name of humanity, right? So they continue to suggest that this would be a sort of adequate strategy to fight the business of smuggling, as they call it, which is in the end an old myth and lie that they keep repeating, right? So we all know that the harder it is for people to cross borders, the more support they need from elsewhere, the more costly, the more dangerous, the more deadly these journeys become. And I think it's not necessarily the inability of European leaders to connect the dots, right, between migrant death and border policies. The causality is really just there for everyone to see. But it is a sort of conscious discursive strategy to deflect from, you know, the core issues and the core reasons. Because, of course, if you blame smugglers solely for migrant death, then you can enact your militaristic border practices.
Is it to the migrants, to the would-be migrants' advantage that the political situation in Libya continues to be so volatile, in the sense that if Libya were more stable, that perhaps it would be more effective, the authorities would be more effective in carrying out the, you know, the border security functions that have been delegated to it by the European Union?
In some ways, yes, and in other ways, no. So we see that other countries in Northern Africa, you know, closely collaborate with the EU's, making it nearly impossible for sea migration to happen, say, from Tunisia and from Egypt. So in some ways, this is true, that if, you know, European border authorities collaborate very closely with Libya, it disallows the opportunity to cross into Europe. But we, of course, know also that the situation is so dangerous now within Libya that a lot of, especially sub-Saharan Africans, only have decided to leave because it has become so precarious and dangerous, which is, of course, related to the NATO intervention in Libya. So there's a direct responsibility for European actions, military actions in Libya, which made the situation highly unstable, and leaving this vacuum there, which allows some to migrate, which is true, but it also allows for an incredible, unstable and dangerous situation for the people who live there.
Maurice Stierl, visiting assistant professor of Comparative Border Studies at UC Davis, a member of the activist project Watch the Med Alarm Phone. We've been focusing on a lot of things, including an article he wrote about the role of grief in migration struggles for the journal Citizenship Studies. Maurice, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.